Welcome to Real Money with David Holland, the show that focuses on real people, real problems, and real solutions. David is a certified financial planner with over 20 years of financial experience. And because he actually provides advice to clients on a daily basis, our hyperactive compliance department wants us to tell you that David Holland is an investment advisor representative of Holland Advisory Services, a registered investment advisory firm. He also offers insurance and annuity products through Holland Insurance Services. Holland Advisory Services and Holland Insurance Services are separate affiliated companies that share common ownership under Holland Financial. Commentary given during this radio program is usually pretty smart, but should not be considered investment, insurance, tax, or legal advice. Views expressed concerning specific securities should not be considered an offer to buy or sell. Investment advice and financial planning services can only be given after an analysis of an individual's situation, only if you hire David and his firm to help you, and only available where Holland Advisory Services is registered or exempt from registering. And now, ladies and gentlemen, here comes the unfiltered truth about money, investing, and retirement planning from a man who will give it to you straight. No bias and no spin. Here he is, David Holland.
Welcome. Hey, I know that intro is very long. I'm sitting here listening to it myself. I'm going to work on making that a little shorter, but there are some things we have to tell you before I can start the program. Unlike some of the other people that do radio shows, I do financial work every day. And because of that, I got rules that they don't have to follow. And I also don't do a drive-by shooting of the financial topics. I usually try to stick to stuff that I know of what I'm talking about when I talk to you about them on the program. All right, so I've got a couple things that I wanted to share with you today, and I think you'll find them very interesting. You know, you ever feel like there's questions you'd like to ask, and you're just not sure where to ask them or who might be able to help you? Well, you can send them to me, info@davidholland.com. If you've got a financial question, I'd love to answer it. If it's something that I can answer on the show, I can either put it on the radio show or I can do it in my column. But I wanted to share, so here's an example. I had a couple of readers and listeners who sent some questions to me, and I'm going to answer them. The first one, so just kind of sit back, relax, and let's dive in here. First one is from Harry in Volusia, and I love Harry's question. He makes a lot of statements, but he's really asking me a question as you listen to it. So let me read the question and his statements, and then I'll provide some feedback, and I imagine that many of you listening to this program have the same questions. So here we go. Harry says, and I'm going to change it to third person so it's easier for me to read it to you. Read your column, and it keeps occurring to Harry that just like any profession, you, meaning me, I have my share of bad apples. For example, in a recent column in the paper, the gentleman says that he also recently retired, and it's kind of a scary decision. He did some math, and for him, the numbers looked okay. He also attended a retirement seminar sponsored by a union organization. The speaker who was making that presentation was pushing annuities, which sounded real good to Harry until he did a little bit of research, and he realized that that's not the way to go. Parenthetically, he says, the only thing I know about financial planning is I have money saved, and I want to keep it and possibly get more of it. Well, that sounds good to me too, Harry. I also spoke, says Harry, with five financial planners, three major firms, my credit union, and another one he found on the internet who was local. He had a Monte Carlo simulation done. That's when they do the little what-if scenarios a whole bunch of times to see what might happen when you're drawing money out of a investment account. One of the advisors, planners, told Harry he was in good shape. Another one told him he didn't have enough insurance. After listening to all that, which Harry says really felt like a lot of pitches, he decided for his semi-conservative portfolio that he'd just keep it in the TSP. That's a plan for federal workers. He's going to keep it there until he turns 70 and a half, and then he's just going to pull out what he has to and maybe do some CDs or a Roth mutual fund. He said his decision to do this was based on two things. First, he didn't have much understanding of the market. He didn't think anybody on Wall Street does either. He says Bernanke sneezes, the traders panic, and then the first guy who opens his mouth on the floor to say sell, everyone else thinks that he knows something they don't, so they sell also. And then a week later, after some common sense arrives, then things settle back down and people start buying again. Harry concludes with the economy is getting better and maybe not by leaps and bounds, but it's improving. And what he thinks we need on Wall Street is more optimists and fewer pessimists. Well, Harry, I agree with a lot of what you shared in your question and statements. And so for the benefit of all of my listeners, and I want to talk a little bit about this, Harry. First of all, I love the fact that you didn't jump into anything. So I've got a series of I loves here for you, Harry. I love the fact you didn't jump into anything. I love the fact that you interviewed more than one advisor. I love when people interview three advisors or more. And, you know, quite candidly, that's great for the individual. It's been great for me. I like when people do that because it really gives you some perspective about how financial advisors work. Now, you can shortcut this process. You can get my book, How to Get Great Advice and Avoid Scams, and that's on my website, and you can also get it on Amazon, and I give you all the questions to ask an advisor. But I love, Harry, that you interviewed five advisors. That's excellent. I like that, as I said earlier, you're not rushing into anything, and I love your humor, and I love your perspective. I want to give you some additional, I guess, some food for thought here. One, I think that going into laddered CDs, even though you are conservative, is probably not going to serve you well long term, because we will have at some point some significant inflation, and the CDs are, you're going to be losing money on an inflation adjusted basis every year with that strategy. The other thing I will mention is that you shouldn't do just one thing. I love a big diversified portfolio with all kinds of different things in it, different strategies, and that includes considering, doesn't mean you have to do it, but I would definitely not rule out the annuities. You may have been presented with one that was not appropriate for you, and I might very well agree if I knew more about your situation, but I can tell you that the annuities can be good for providing income and can also be a place to put money where it can be safer, okay? But there are some that I don't recommend. So don't rule them out. And I also would say, don't give up. You know, you went to five financial advisors. Well, do a search. In fact, look for some CFPs, Certified Financial Planners. Harry didn't mention that in his question, but go to CFP.net and maybe, you know, find three more that are convenient, local for you, and continue your conversation, because I don't think that you're really going to be long-term served with just a CD strategy. And I can tell you that, you know, using a combination of conservative investments, things that are more growth-oriented, you know, keeping some money liquid, some cash money, some emergency money, you know, kind of putting a plan together really is what this is all about, Harry. And that's what's lacking based on what you describe in your situation. If you put a plan together, it'll help you look the other way, so to speak, or when Bernanke sneezes, or at least hand him a handkerchief, okay? I mean, it'll put you in a position to where you can accept those ups and downs of the market, and that's just the nature of the beast that we have with the market. Okay, Harry, I hope that helps you. I'm going to take a quick break and come back, and I'm going to answer another question, this one from Bill, about estate taxes, so stay right there.
There are hundreds of annuities available in today's marketplace. How can you know if one is right for you? Certified financial planner David Holland answers this question and more in his educational booklet on annuities. To get your free copy, call Holland Financial at 888-747-PLAN. The annuity booklet provides a plain English explanation of the different types of annuities so you can decide if one is a good fit for your situation. Again, that number is 888-747-7526.
Hey, welcome back. We're going over some reader questions. I talked before the break about Harry and his question and his perspective. And I want to reiterate that it's really essential that, you know, if you're trying to figure out what to do for your retirement planning, is really to sit down with somebody that's experienced and has the expertise to guide you. And very often, you're going to want a mix of strategies, not all one thing. No matter what it is, you know, you don't want all your money just in stocks, or you don't want all your money just in an annuity, or you don't want all your money in cash or CDs. A mix often works best. Okay, now on to the next question, which comes from Bill. And Bill's question is in follow-up to a column I'd written talking about estate taxes. And his question is really about whether, if the government were to change the way estate taxes work. And I'll read you part of his question. As you know, the gross estate before income taxes is subject to change by the government. It has switched from $1 million to $5 million in values in between in the past years. Bill assumes that our government can certainly legislate changes in the number in the future as they have in the past. The question is, what happens if the gross estate for estate tax purposes is lower than the future and the sum of all of your Form 709 gifts you've made exceed the non-taxable value of the gross estate at the time of death? Are the gifts that were allowable under the old limit subject to tax under the new limit? Look forward to your answer to this question, Bill. Happy to answer, Bill. And I'm going to translate all that into plain English for everyone. And what Bill's question is about is, it's about right now, and I've talked about this on previous programs and I've written columns about this. And you can go to my website, davidholland.com, and there's an archive of all the columns, and you can see the ones that are about estate taxes. But what Bill's question is about is we have right now an exemption amount. Everybody walks around with a lifetime exemption amount of $5,250,000. And I've talked on previous shows, and I've written about it in my column, that unless you have that, really, you know, there's not a lot for you to be concerned about. And what Bill's reminding me is that, well, what if they change that, David? What if they change it from $5,250,000, they drop it down to, say, $1 million, which it wasn't long ago that the amount you could exempt when you die or if you give it during your lifetime was, and I'm going to use this word carefully, just $1 million. Just $1 million compared to $5.25 million is just $1 million, but $1 million is obviously a lot of money. Now, Bill's question is, what if they change the rules on us? And because if you have $3 million, $4 million, $2 million, whatever somebody's situation is, if they've got that, then they really don't need to be all that concerned. They still need to, you know, I routinely recommend people talk to an attorney and, of course, get good financial advice. But there's not a lot to be concerned about having to worry about your estate being subject to estate taxes if you've got less than the $5.25 million. And for married couples, it's double that. Well, so the question is, what if they change the rules on us? And, you know, they could change the rules. You know, if you have both houses of Congress and the president agree on something, they can pretty much do what they're going to do with taxes, right? I mean, they could change it to where you pay taxes at 70% if they wanted to, if they all could agree. And that is the, you know, the other side of Congress and the White House completely agreeing that we have to always be concerned about, okay? But let's say that, let me give you a hypothetical to really answer this question in a nutshell. Let's say that at some point, as part of some grand compromise, the Congress and the White House agree to lower the estate tax exemption, which is the amount you can leave your heirs or give as a gift during your lifetime to your heirs, whoever you want. Let's say they lower that from 5.25 down to $1 million. Well, the key is that they usually apply these laws, and I say usually, I mean most of the time. I only know of a few really isolated situations. They usually apply all these changes prospectively, meaning going forward into the future. So if they made the change, then whatever you've done in the past, they don't go back and punish you for it. So if our exemption amount is 5.25 now, and you have a significant estate, when I say that, if you're over the 5.25 or you've got 4 or 3 million, then you certainly should talk with your attorney, estate planning attorney, about whether or not you should make gifts under the current tax law instead of, you know, just kind of waiting. Because if they change it, then they're not going to go back and say, well, you gave more in the past, because those gifts would be grandfathered in. And so the best strategy is to look at where things are now. And I'll give you an example. I have made recommendations to families that are wealthier, that have a significant amount of assets, to go ahead and use their exemption now during their lifetime, to go ahead and make gifts. And I talked about this previously. You can go over the $14,000. You know, the $14,000 annual gift limit is not really a limit. It's the amount you can give without eating into your lifetime exemption amount. So you can give $14,000 a year to 1,000 people if you wanted to, and you don't pay tax, they don't pay tax, and it doesn't go against that $5.25 million you have that's a lifetime exemption. So if somebody's situation is that they want to try to take advantage of the current exemption amount and they've got enough assets, then they want to go ahead and give $1 million to a family member or to the grandkids or the kids or whatever that is, or put it into a trust for them, they can do that and go ahead and reduce their exemption amount now. And then if the rules change later, the IRS is not going to, it would be extraordinary for the IRS to come back and say, well, you know, you made that gift before, we're going to hit you with a tax on it now. If you followed the rules at the time, they can't penalize you later under new rules for having followed the rules in the past. Okay, does that make sense? So that's what this question is all about. And so I'm glad to have an opportunity to answer that for Bill and for the rest of the listeners. And I know that, and again, I want to end this point with this. If you have less than $5.25 million and you've got $500,000, or you've got $200,000, or you've got $100,000, or you've got $3 million. If you're under 5 1/4 and you want to give somebody $15,000, $20,000, $30,000, $50,000, $100,000. I had somebody the other day that wanted to give away a home to a friend that was worth about $250,000, $250,000. They can give that to their friend without an estate, gift, or inheritance tax. No death tax, no inheritance tax, no gift tax, none of that. They have to file the 709, which is the form you send to the IRS to let them know that you've made that gift. If you make a gift over $14,000, you're supposed to do that. And there's no tax. There's no tax for their giving it. There's no tax for the recipient. Now, once the recipient gets it, if they do something with it, there are some income tax potential consequences related to capital gains, because you do a carryover basis. The person that gives the property to the other person, their basis, what they originally paid for it, transfers over and is used when the person sells the property. So if it was $100,000, the original person bought it for, and they give it when it's worth $250,000, the $100,000 is still the basis for the person receiving the property. And then when they sell it, they use the same $100,000 basis that the person who had it did. But there is no gift, estate, inheritance tax for any of that stuff that I just described, unless you have a lot more money. So the $14,000, which I also wrote about and talked about on a previous show, the $14,000 is not really a gift limit. It's not really a limit. It's an allowance. That's a better way to put it. It's how much you're allowed to give. You can give anything you want. And so even to call it an allowance is a little bit of a misnomer. You can give anybody anything you want. The only question are there tax consequences. And unless you're over that $5.25 million, there really aren't going to be tax consequences for you from an estate or gift transfer tax. Okay? Sorry to belabor the point, but I just want to make sure it's clear. All right, we're going to take a quick break and we'll be right back.
Have you noticed most of the financial literature available is either so specific it doesn't apply or too generic to answer even the most basic questions? This revelation inspired David Holland to write his first two books, Confessions of a Financial Planner, Secrets to a Secure Retirement, and How to Get Great Advice and Avoid Financial Scams. These how-to guides contain easily accessible information on a wide variety of topics concerning personal finances. An effortless weekend read. You'll find clarification on what a mutual fund is, how to choose the right financial professional, and much more. Call Holland Financial at 888-747-PLAN to request a free excerpt from David's first book, Secrets to a Secure Retirement. The number again is 888-747-7526. Or visit davidholland.com for more information on this innovative book series.
And we're back. Hey, how about a HELOC? What's a HELOC? Home Equity Line of Credit. I've been seeing stories written, and I picked one up here from financialplanning.com. And Donald J. Korn was the writer of this article. And he talked at length about the advantages, or the title is Time for Advisors to Revisit HELOCs. And so Home Equity Line of Credit. And it got me thinking, I wanted to talk a little bit about this on the program today. For a while there, you know, it was super easy money, okay? If you had your primary mortgage, or you have no debt, of course, on your house, you could get a home equity line of credit from your bank, and they would be pretty generous with it because, you know, hey, back in, what, 2000, early 2000s, the home market was just on fire. Banks were, and I'm not a banker, and I don't read their minds, but, you know, my sense was bankers were like, hey, you know, these values are all going up. Our risk is pretty low. Well, then, of course, everybody knows what happened with the meltdown in 2008 and our Great Recession. And a lot of people got notices if they had a HELOC that they were frozen. So what happens is, you know, you have your first mortgage if you have the debt. And then if you have a second mortgage, which is usually a home equity line of credit, the first mortgage is primary. The second one is second. That's why they call it that. So what happens is you could either get the home equity line of credit whether you have a first mortgage or not. If you have a first mortgage, then it's secondary. So the lender, which is often, at least in my own personal situation, that's the way I've seen it done, is you have the first mortgage and then the second mortgage could be at the same bank. But if you have a first mortgage and then and a second mortgage and the home prices fall like they did over the last several, you know, years leading up to where, of course, things were coming back up now. But what happened is a lot of banks froze those HELOCs and they stopped offering them, and they, you know, you weren't able to borrow any more money because the values of the property that's collateral for these loans, they fell in value. And because the HELOC is typically the second mortgage, there was a real possibility. And a lot of banks, of course, experienced this, that they took losses on those. But so they became kind of like a big frozen lake in the winter somewhere up north. My friends in Minneapolis that experienced those freezing of those lakes. But we're starting to see a thaw. We're starting to see banks open up their wallets, starting to make loans again. So I wanted to talk for a few minutes on the program about the HELOCs because they can be a good financial tool. Now, I am not going to tell you to go get a HELOC so we can invest the money. Okay? That is not the point. But if you, depending on what rate you can get on your HELOC, generally they're tied to the prime rate. Generally, if prime is 3.25, then you may be at prime or however much over prime. So let's just say you're at prime and you're at 3.25. You've got good credit and you've got good equity and you're at 3.25. Then that's a pretty good rate. Now, I don't recommend people go borrow that money and say, okay, well, I'll borrow at 3.25 and I can go make 15% in the market, right? I mean, the market's up quite a bit. Well, that is that's a gamble. And I don't recommend acquiring debt for the purpose of investing. However, it is a good source of money that you can, number one, use to pay off other high interest debt, especially if you've got another form of debt that is going to have an interest rate that's going to jump up. You can, you know, kind of shuffle around and pay some things off, credit card debt or auto loans, these different things you can pay off. And the other thing I really like about a home equity line of credit, of course, there's interest deductions and things like that. But the thing I like about it is it's a fantastic emergency reserve. And generally, I like to see about 5% of somebody's total asset, investable assets, be in a cash reserve. So if somebody's got simple math, somebody's got $100,000 to invest, I'd like them to keep $5,000 in emergency. Or if they've got $500,000 to invest, I'd like to see $25,000 stay in a cash reserve. If you add in a line of credit, the home equity line of credit, that could actually allow you to have that as part of your emergency reserve and not have to hold so much back. I like that because the whole point of having that cash there and not investing it or doing something with it is in case you need to go get money quickly. Well, if you have a line of credit, and again, everybody's situation is different, but if you've got a line of credit and there's no, you know, there's no real risk that the bank is going to pull it. Now, they could. Banks can do anything they want. They can pull that line of credit. They don't have to keep it. Now, if you've already got money on it, then, you know, they're not going to send you a bill and say, okay, you got to pay in 10 days. But if you've got a unused line of credit, they can pull that anytime they want. So I don't want to go too thin on cash, but it is a good idea if you have it available. Now, I know there's a cost to getting a line of credit. A lot of times the banks will work with you, especially if they're trying to earn your business. It's great for business owners. As you know, the business owners like to have lines of credit through their business. Obviously, that makes it a little cleaner. But sometimes the business itself doesn't have enough credit or history, so the business owner can get a line of credit. Maybe it's on their home or whatever they however they want to structure their finances. But having it as a backup is a really smart thing to do. And with the banks being more willing to look at home equity lines of credit again, I think it's time to do that. Now, the only caveat or thing I will point out, you know, at the time of the taping of this show, because this is going to go in our archive, the rates are still very low and on interest rates, and the Federal Reserve is still buying bonds at $85 billion a month. I suspect it's going to be quite a while yet before the prime rate goes up, because the prime rate, as I've talked about on this program, the prime rate is a function of the Federal Reserve rate or discount rate, what the banks lend each other for overnight money in their banks. And so, you know, that's about 0.25%. So the prime is usually about 3% over that discount rate. So I don't, until they've stopped printing more money, quote unquote, until they've stopped the quantitative easing that they've been using to buy bonds, to buy our 10-year treasury. So the Fed buying the 10-year treasuries from ourselves, until they stop doing that, I don't think they're going to raise the discount rate and cause the prime rate to go up. So I think home equity lines will have a lower rate than some of the other alternatives for quite a while yet. But that is a risk that if you do put money on a home equity line of credit, just understand that that rate could go up because it's tied to prime. Okay, that's all the time I have for you today. Be sure to tune in next time.
Want to learn more about Real Money with David Holland? Visit us at realmoneyradio.com, where you can listen live or to the archives. You can also email us your questions, comments, or show ideas to info@realmoneyradio.com. Be sure to like us on Facebook at Real Money with David Holland.
Remember, nobody cares more about your money than you do. This has been Real Money with David Holland. Thank you for listening.